This is Tofu Dave on your community radio station, WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carborough, with another edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie. And I'm honored today to have the author of Lydia Mariah Child, A Radical American Life, with me by phone, Lydia Moland, the author of this new book, Lydia Mariah Child, A Radical American Life. Welcome, Dr. Molin, to Between the Covers. We're glad to have you here today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really excited to be with you.
Now, we are in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We've had our own struggles in the past with questions of race and incarceration and slavery and all those kinds of things. And your book opened my eyes a little bit to the life of a woman in the first half of the 1800s who somehow went from being, in my understanding, a housewife who was into self-help and how to clean your house and maybe cook for your husband to what I think you call a radical abolitionist. It amazed me. How did this happen? How did this woman transform herself at a time when this country was grappling, or really at her time, maybe even not yet really dealing with questions of slavery? Give us a little insight.
She was already a very well-established novelist and self-help author. She was, I think, essentially the 19th century equivalent of a household name. But she had a kind of sense of social justice, and she had been exposed especially to Native Americans in Maine, where she lived as a teenager, in ways that made her open to the idea that maybe her government was not as progressive and democratic and dedicated to the equality of all as it claimed to be. And I think that opened her up to a certain kind of sympathetic suspicion. So she was, I think, vaguely disapproving of slavery. She wished that slavery didn't exist, but like many Northerners at that time, assumed that nothing could be done about it and that it would probably go away on its own, and really just didn't think that it was any of her business to get involved with, until she met a man named William Lloyd Garrison, who was one of the most fire-breathing white abolitionists in the Boston area. And I say white abolitionists because there was a deep and established Black abolitionist community already in Boston that William Lloyd Garrison himself learned from. When Lydia Mariah Child met him, he made arguments to her that meant that she couldn't live her life the same way again. She suddenly realized that she had been ignoring this massive atrocity that her country was engaged in. And she had a kind of conversion experience, changed her life, never lived her life the same way again, and spent the next half century fighting slavery in every way she knew how, including writing books, but also putting her body between abolitionist speakers and anti-abolitionist mobs. She fundraised to end slavery. She wrote books for enslaved people. It became her life's mission in ways that are, I think, even today, very surprising.
From a fairly poor, lest I say working class, but poor background, and she grew up living around many different kinds of basically disadvantaged poor people, and that may have influenced her later radical conversion to become a leader in the abolition movement.
I think that's true. And it's also true that even though she was mostly working class, as you say, she was exposed to people who were really struggling. And one of the things that she disliked most was Americans' pursuit of wealth and consumerism in ways that she thought blinded them to the suffering of others, but also made them aristocratic in a way that I think wasn't long since the Revolutionary War when she was writing. And she just thought, well, didn't we fight a war to get rid of this kind of class system? And now Americans are going to pursue wealth on the backs of other humans that they enslave. And what kind of future does a country like that have? And I don't mean to suggest that she was perfect. She had many attitudes towards even the Black people that she was advocating for that were paternalistic or prejudicial. But I think she was more progressive on those questions as well than most of her contemporaries.
Yes, and when I characterize her as a writer of self-help books, that probably is sort of an unfair way to put it, because her motivation in writing those books seemed to have been one of frugality and self-reliance and sort of self-internal strength, as opposed to a self-help book where you're trying to emulate somebody above you in a in a stratified society. But I also want to turn to another possible flaw that's striking in your book and may lead people to want to read it, which was her interesting relationship to her husband. You do a very good job of talking about her personal life, I think, in a fairly straightforward and objective way that many of us today are maybe afraid to talk to each other about. But since she lived quite a while ago, we can. And her husband, apparently, while he appears to have, in your recounting, loved her and treated her personally very well, he was also somewhat of a maybe you should say, a unreliable partner, in that he had all sorts of dreams of financial success that were money pits, and much of her earnings from her books really went into supporting her husband, who, it appears in your recounting, she stood by all of her life. So that's seemed to me to be one of the contradictions between sort of, in a way, her politics and her personal life that we all grapple with probably in our own lives. Am I misreading?
No, that's beautifully put. Yeah, he not only was he sort of walking financial disaster, his idealistic schemes were also really well intentioned, and he was a radical abolitionist himself. And so all of his money-making schemes had to do with trying to end slavery, including the most bizarre one, to my mind, is when they moved to Western Massachusetts to farm sugar beets in the hopes of undermining the plantation cane sugar trade. So no one had ever made sugar from beets in the United States before, but he decided to try. He poured all of their resources into it. She poured all of her literary earnings into it, and it failed. Sugar beets now make up a very high percentage of the amount of sugar that we eat. So he wasn't wrong that it was possible, but he did not manage to undermine slavery by doing it. And this became so painful to her that they did actually separate for about 6 or 7 years. It just became clear to her that if she was going to survive emotionally, but also financially, she had to extricate herself from his financial disasters. But the thing I love the most about their story, and you bring this out nicely in your question too, is they recommitted to each other later in their lives. And I have to admit that when I first read that, I didn't think it was going to work. I thought, people don't change that much. I'm sure he just went back to his terrible behavior. But in the end, I think he did change, and she supported him. And they both said that they spent the best years of their life, the last two decades that they lived together, and he died in her arms.
Wow, wonderful love story. This is, again, Tofu Dave on Between the Covers, a literature quickie, talking with Lydia Molin, the author of Lydia Mariah Child, A Radical American Life, a book. I hope it's as interesting to the listeners as it is to me. I want to fast forward in the couple minutes we have left to today. You know, around our area here in North Carolina and in many other parts of the country, there are a lot of debates about monuments to slavery and slave owners. We've had a big bunch of discussion and incidents on the UNC campus here in Chapel Hill, where finally a monument called Silent Sam, Confederate soldier facing north with his rifle, was finally removed from campus recently. In another nearby town where some friends of yours and mine live, Graham, North Carolina, they're still debating at the courthouse square. There's a Confederate monument that their solution to the controversy was to put a fence around it so nobody could get near it and leave it at the courthouse square. So in the remaining minute we have left, I just want to fast forward to lessons for today. What can you and I and our friends learn from the life of Lydia Mariah Child, a radical American, for our lives today? What, and I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but what do you think we should be doing as Americans living in a, quote, democracy today in our lives?
She understood that she was probably part of the problem. She understood that she benefited from economic and social facts about her country that harmed others. She understood that the history that she was a part of was harmful to others. And she was fiercely determined to address that and be honest about it. So I think we need to engage in that kind of fierce humility. I also think we need to look for what is staring us in the face that is an atrocity in a way that slavery was an atrocity, but Child and others were able to ignore it for parts of their lives. And to me, you mentioned it already, I think it's the mass incarceration system. I think whatever angle you look at the mass incarceration system from, there is a deep and horrendous injustice going on, and it's hidden in plain sight for most of us. And so I think Child was the kind of person who said, let us not flatter ourselves, let us find out what we need to change and get into changing it.
Well put, Lydia Moland, author of Lydia Mariah Child, A Radical American Life. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie here with Tofu Dave on WCOM-LP-FM, your community radio station. And I think you're right. What we need in life is a little bit of fierce humility.
Thank you,
Dr. Moland, for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Again, this is Tofu Dave on Between the Covers, a literature quickie, WCOMLP FM, your community radio station in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, North Carolina.